similar such cases, I locate all relevant information and compile it in a way that lets me anticipate what's about to happen as a result. If I know what is likely coming, then I can act instead of react, and this gives me a huge advantage in being able to avoid danger and even be able to turn the tables and make the situation work for me. If instead of getting eaten by a saber-toothed tiger, I instead end up eating the saber-toothed tiger, I'm much better off. The problem, of course, is locating all the information and only the relevant information, feeding it into the part of my brain that can use it to make a prediction, get the prediction, and act on it before the saber-toothed tiger pounces. Tigers are very quick. This process has to be even quicker. But with all the steps, it isn't. If the process takes even a fraction of a second too long, it's not only worthless, it's harmful. The advantage of intelligence becomes a detriment. So, we need to speed up the search process and the modeling of reality for a prediction process. To do this, we create what Hurley, Dennett, and Adams call a mental space. That is, I create a flattened, simplified universe that contains only a small fraction of the full complexity of the real world. Because I'm predicting what will happen in this simplified universe, there's a lot of information I can ignore because it hasn't been imported into the stripped-down world. This allows me to be much quicker in my predictions, to work them out fast enough to have time to react in the real world in real time. But what I left out of my model might end up being relevant. The stripped-down version might not be coherent. There might be mistakes in how I constructed it. Any of this is the case? Then the predictions will be flawed and my expectations will not be rational. As a result, the creation of mental spaces is no longer advantageous, but disadvantageous. Mistakes can get me killed. So, in addition to needing the ability to create and populate these flattened models of reality, I also need a fact checker for my fake world. I need a part of my mind which quickly searches the mental space for reasoning errors. If there is an error, I need to know it before I create and act on the prediction. So, this new fact-checker capacity has to be quick as well. But extra functionality means extra energy. We have to pay for the work, and we want to use as little energy as possible. So how can the body create an incentive for the spending of this extra energy? Well, if it finds a mistake, you get a shot of neurochemical happy juice. Finding mistakes in mental spaces yields bodily pleasure. All of this is wonderful, but what does it have to do with humor? We do not often, especially in the modern world, find ourselves in the sort of situation where we need to process a mental space model at top speed. We don't often find ourselves with the need to check them. We therefore do not often get that reward which we'd really like to have. But we have figured out a way to game the system. We can create fake situations in which we place ourselves with pre-planted mistakes baked into the crust, so to speak. These are jokes. What is a joke? It's a verbal story that leads us to create a fake world with a mistake hidden in it. We hear the setup. We create the corresponding mental space. We hear the punchline. We're puzzled until we get the joke. What is getting a joke? It's the realization that the information in the punchline cannot be true if the mental space world is the way we originally took it to be. The mental space must be recreated in a way that corrects the error exposed by the punchline. We find the error, and the brain responds by giving us the reward, the pleasure we seek. This is why we love humor. It makes us feel good. It works because the brain is wired for it. Not because humor played an advantageous role itself in human evolution, rather because there's another faculty that was advantageous and we figured out how to rig the brain to fake the situation to cash in undeservingly on the reward it gives us for saving our own lives. As such, humor is not necessary, But to be human with a brain that works in the real world, a sense of humor would be. So, we see that the necessity of humor in human life depends on the picture one has of the human soul or human mind. If any of these are right, then perhaps we ought to consider Richard Pryor and not James Brown to be the true godfather of soul.
Lecture 22, Comedian Ethics.
Hey, Steve, you did stand-up, right?
Yeah, I did. Well, amateur open mic stuff. You know, it was a bunch of years ago, but yeah.
Did you ever do any jokes in your college classes that you did on stage?
Well, no. See, comedy is done in bars full of drunk college students. Classrooms are full of hungover college students. It's a subtle difference, but it makes a difference.
Well, what were some jokes that you told on stage that you wouldn't tell in your classroom?
Now, had this one bit. I used to do a thing on license plates. You know, you could tell a lot about a state just by the color of their license plate. Texas, red, white, and blue. Alabama, red, white, and blue. North Carolina, red, white, and blue. New Jersey, yellow. The exact shade of urine. Vermont? Green. The shade of green where you figure to get your plates, you don't go to the DMV. You have to go around back to the parking lot where a guy in a van hands them to you in a rolled up Ziploc baggie. South Carolina has a new Strom Thurmond Memorial plate coming out. It's all white with eye holes cut into it.
Strom Thurmond?
Yeah. That's another reason I don't do my old stand-up material in today's classrooms. Context matters when we examine the moral standing of an utterance. There are things one can say to a romantic partner or a close friend that one cannot say to a stranger. But what if those strangers have paid the cover charge to enter a comedy club? What if those strangers are watching a stand-up routine online or on television? All the discussions we've had so far have concerned the sort of humorous interactions we have in normal life. But what about comedy as an art form? What are the moral differences in play when a joke is told by someone whose job it is to entertain us? Is it the case that, morally, a joke is a joke is a joke? Or should we hold comedians to different moral standards? Do professional joke tellers get a longer moral leash? The strongest advocates for the view that comedians ought to be given a wider moral berth in what they can say in public are, to no one's surprise, comedians themselves. Some argue the extreme position that stand-up comedy is and ought to be an amoral activity. Comedy occurs in an ethics-free zone. As a type of art, it's exempt from our usual ethical standards. Others argue for a more moderate position, that there's a line comedians shouldn't cross, but that line is farther out than it is for non-comedians. Still others take a harder line, that jokes, even or especially funny jokes, can cause real harm to society. But this presumes that there's something special about comedy. Others will argue that speech is speech. There's no reason that humor in general, much less comedy in particular, should enjoy special moral privileges. Indeed, comedy can be especially pernicious when we allow it outside the bounds of normal allowable speech. Let's start by considering the argument for the broadest moral permissibility. This is a view that comedy frees the comedian from all ethical boundaries. This line tends to be justified on two very different grounds, one linguistic and one ethical. The linguistic justification is based on the idea that stand-up comedy is an art form. Comedians are not statesmen. They're not on stage to change minds, advocate for policy, or make arguments. They're artists just trying to get laughs. Remember Immanuel Kant? He said that humorous statements, jokes, are empty statements. The philosophical term is semantically vacuous. That is, jokes don't really say anything about anything. The linguist Victor Raskin introduced the philosophically important distinction between verbal acts that are bona fide and those are non-bona fide, right? We've been using this throughout the series. Raskin is expanding on the work of the philosopher H.P. Grice, who argues that conversation is an essentially cooperative endeavor, and therefore must be governed by rules. When we talk to each other, there are maxims we have learned to obey. You know to make your contribution to the conversation relevant. Don't talk about random stuff. Stick to the topic. You know that you should only say what you actually believe. Be honest in your conversational contributions. Be clear in saying what you had to say and only say as much as is needed to make your point. When we follow these rules, we participate in conversation appropriately, and our interlocutor can leave the conversation with new beliefs or at least a sense of what we believe. This is bona fide communication. It's conversation where I take the ideas in my head and through the use of words and gestures, put them in your head. But that's not what humor does, Raskin argues. It's communication. When I tell you a joke, I put ideas in your head that are in my head that you didn't have before, but it's not bona fide. You have these new ideas in your head, but you don't believe that I believe them, and you do not believe that I want you to believe them, and most likely you don't believe them. You don't think that a chicken did cross the road, that a psychiatrist was changing a light bulb, or that the Pope, a rabbi, and Madonna walked into a bar. The instant you recognize that what is happening is humor, then you listen differently. You process the verbal act differently. You understand it differently. You look for the joke, not for the information to believe. You try to get it, not believe it. If this is true for normal joking by non-professionals like us, then it must be even more true for contexts in which we seek out professional joke tellers. No one listens to comedy for information. Comedy is meaningless. We appreciate it for its artistry, not for its content. But if it's meaningless, then it can't have moral weight attached to it. Any attempt to place moral restrictions on comedy is mistaken because it's treating jokes like normal speech. It's confusing non-bona fide for bona fide communication. As such, comedians can say whatever they want with no regard for issues of morality. A presupposition of this view leads us to our second justification for the position that there are no moral restrictions on comedians. The presupposition is that listeners hear the words of a comedian differently than they hear the words of a normal speaker. What's the basis for this? The answer is a social contract. This is a notion that comes to us from a philosopher we've seen in a different context, Thomas Hobbes. Recall that Hobbes is one of the advocates for the superiority theory of humor, according to which humor is the realization of sudden glory. Humor comes from asserting one's superiority over another. Humor is about power. Lots of Hobbes's thought is about power. Living through the horrors of the English Civil War, Hobbes worried about the use of power to subjugate and harm others. It is, he thinks, part of the basis of human nature. Human civilization is a development. It's not a natural state for us. Rather, it's something we created. Our natural state is the state of nature. In the state of nature, it's each against all others. We're all out for ourselves in a deadly game of survival. We all have the natural right to do anything that'll help us survive. Now, everything is potentially helpful, and so we all have the right to everything. But this means that there's a constant conflict of rights, and this leads to a state of all-out war. But war leads to shorter lifespans. If our goal is to survive, then we could all benefit if we could leave the state of nature. But that means renouncing our right to all things. Now, if only one of us did this, that person would be killed. The only way out is for us to renounce our rights together and redistribute the rights in a way that leads to social stability. That is the social contract. It's an agreement we all enter into that gives unique, non-overlapping rights to each individual. And as long as the contract is enforced, peace can reign. And we can all live longer. Some argue that there are distinct social contracts that govern different parts of society. Roseanne Barr, for example, argues that there's something like a Hobbesian social contract that you enter into by walking into a comedy club or tuning into a particular TV or radio channel. Different comedy clubs, television outlets, and satellite radio stations have different levels of offensive speech. If you walk in or tune in, then you have implicitly agreed to the contract. That gives the comedian a right to be as offensive as the club or station advertises. And some of these outlets are no holds barred. Some comedy clubs are such that anything goes. There are, and must be, for the sake of the development of the art form, places where comedians are allowed to say literally anything. We advance comedy by experiments that push the envelope. Whether it's Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, Sam Kinison, or Bill Hicks, comedy greats emerge from the ability to shock and offend, to take it a step farther than those before them. Now, not all would-be revolutionaries succeed, but even if they go down in flames, they had to be given the right to try. And that requires the right to go anywhere their art took them. Comedians like Roseanne argue that comedy must be free from moral constraint and that the comedy club is a sacred space where all agree to give the comedian that ultimate degree of latitude. There is a social contract that justifies the ultimate right to free speech if you have the mic. A modified version of this position comes from those who see a utilitarian value in boundary transgression by comedians. The rights-based approach simply wants to endow comedians with free rein to go anywhere verbally. It argues that there's no line of acceptability. The utilitarian argument, on the other hand, allows that there is a line of social acceptability, but argues that comedians are always allowed to cross it. There is a line, but moving that line is what comedians do and ought to do for the good of us all. The philosopher Noel Coward, one of the biggest names in the philosophy of art, who's taken a serious interest in the philosophy of humor, argues that jokes are an important set of cultural artifacts. Jokes come out of a place and a time where people have a certain way of being with certain beliefs and biases. If we make jokes about women, about those of Polish background, about dead babies, then this tells us nothing about women, Poles, or dead babies, but it tells us a lot about ourselves. Jokes only make sense if you have the required background knowledge. If you do not understand that blonde women are culturally considered to be stupid, that Jews are held to be cheap, or that lawyers are held to be dishonest and self-interested, then blonde, Jewish, and lawyer jokes will make no sense to you. Our jokes are reflections of ourselves. As such, humor can be an important social corrective. Carroll argues that our jokes tell us about our biases, but do so in a way that they're contained in utterances that are designed to contain logical flaws. Jokes tell us what we're afraid of, whom we're marginalizing, and begin to challenge that fear and marginalization. Jokes can help us identify what parts of our society need fixing and start us on the road to fixing it. This line is also embraced by certain shock comedians. Consider Anthony Jeselnik, whose comedy is designed to walk right up to that line and explicitly and proudly cross it. He seems to make his audience squirm, and if one joke doesn't do that, the next one will push it a step farther. He argues, like Carroll, that there's a positive social outcome from this acknowledgement and challenging of boundaries. There are unnecessary social strictures. Society forbids certain things and requires certain things that are illogical, immoral, or stupid. We confuse the social with the moral and enforce the social as if it were the moral. And the social is often problematic. Jeselnik sees the cultural function of his jokes as forcing society to question why it allows and disallows, demands and forbids what it does. This rethinking is a necessary activity for us. We need to question our boundaries and would never do so unless we were forced to do it. Showing us where our boundaries are and crossing them forces the issue. Note that this is a utilitarian argument. The outcome of the act is helpful for the lived lives of people. It's the consequence that justifies the means. But there are those who only agree with this view halfway. They argue that, yes, comedians should play around the boundary, But that does not make all crossing of those boundaries legitimate. Comic writer Lindy West argues this moderate line in a series of newspaper op-eds published in the wake of Daniel Tosh's rape joke controversy. West does not take the view that rape jokes are off limits. She acknowledges that there is a line and argues that comedians should explore that line. She allows that there are comedians, male and female, whose rape jokes remain inside the boundary, on the morally acceptable side. Jokes that cleverly point out aspects of rape culture and the difficulty of being a woman who has to negotiate a world in which she has to put herself out there and yet has to always be on her guard are surely jokes about rape, but also jokes that would surely be allowable on anyone's criteria. But then there are aggressive rape jokes, like those of Tosh, that cross the line and should be rejected. Given the prevalence of sexual violence in today's society, a comedian can be assured that a non-trivial percentage of his or her audience will have experienced the threat of sexual assault, sexual violence, or rape. When one brazenly crosses that boundary in a fashion that glorifies or makes casual the committing of rape, it sends a signal to the audience. It trivializes an act which is not only traumatic for those in the audience who are the victims, but says that their pain is not to be taken seriously. Shakespeare wrote that he jested scars that never felt a wound. To poke fun at the lingering psychological scars is to expose oneself as not understanding the wound that was inflicted. And in doing so, it takes victims who are already trivialized, not believed about their abuse, and who see their abusers rarely brought to justice, and re-victimizes them. Now, this is a deontological argument. We have a duty not to harm. There are jokes that do cause harm. These jokes are thereby morally problematic. The problem is not that the joke dealt with a topic that was off limits, right? West argues that there should be no topics that are off limits to comedians. Comedians are and should be free to explore absolutely any topic. Comedians doing their work can show us different ways of looking at things that can give us insight. Comedy should probe the edges in order to allow us to understand them in a deeper way. But this freedom does not imply that any joke on any topic is allowable. Jokes can harm, and we have a duty not to cause unnecessary harm. Hence, there are moral limits where comedians ought to go. While West takes this more moderate approach, other philosophers and comedians hold that certain jokes are simply wrong and ought to be outright condemned. This is a lesson that West's interlocutor, Roseanne Barr, clearly did not learn from this public conversation, which occurred years before one of her comments on Twitter got her rebooted series canceled. One line we've examined is that jokes should be morally allowed if they're funny. But this hardline position contends that funniness does not let the comedian off the hook. Indeed, funny jokes may be even more pernicious. In his book, Ha, The Science of When We Laugh and Why, author Scott Weems examines what happens in the brain to generate laughter and the mirthful appreciation of humor. He examines not just the neurological, but also the sociological studies that have looked at the effects of humor. He cites studies that considers the effects of behavior, biases, and choice after having heard a joke which is racist or sexist, which shows that these jokes have the special ability to amplify pre-existing biases. Jokes are not factual propositions. When we make jokes, we're not trying to convince anyone of anything. This, of course, is central to the arguments of those who contend that comedians ought to have no moral restrictions. Jokes are not intended to be bona fide communication. Jokes are not intended to be content conveying speech acts. Since they're not seriously asserting any property of any group, there's no responsibility to be assumed. As such, there should be complete latitude in humor. But Weems points out that this has unexpected neurological consequences. Because we recognize jokes as non-bona fide communication, the brain does not engage its critical faculties when processing the content of the joke. We hear the joke, we understand the joke, we get the joke. But we do not evaluate the truth or falsity of the content because it's a joke. However, and this is the important part, the brain still processes the information in the joke as it does with any other memory that involves linguistic information. The content of the joke still makes its way into the brain. It's still coded. But because it comes in through a joke, it, in Weems' words, flies under the radar. Jokes enter the brain like someone at the airport who has a badge allowing him to skip the security screening. He still gets into the airport, but he's not been vetted to see if he's carrying anything harmful. When we look at measures of actions and beliefs following exposure to sexist or racist humor, we see a difference in what we think and how we act. There's a demonstrable effect on our choices and our proclivities following certain jokes. Jokes do change how the brain operates. And if the joke is really funny, the consequence is that we've assimilated that information into our brain and now also associate it with joy. There's not only an enhancement of pre-existing biases, but we are positively inclined towards them. We're given a psychological reward for something that escapes critical examination and can lead to increased bias. This leads some philosophers and comedians to argue that it's completely backward to exempt comedians from moral responsibility for their routines and the jokes they make on stage. If anything, they contend, comedians have a higher moral bar. Because of the possible effects of their work, comedians should be more constrained by moral considerations. Comedian Harry Kondabolu makes this case in his documentary, The Problem with Apu. He examines the social and political meaning of the character Apu from the animated television program, The Simpsons. Apu is the show's only South Asian character and built around the stereotype of South Asians as the owners of convenience stores. Kondabolu sees Apu as funny and himself feels a warmth towards the character, but argues that there's a problem, a moral problem, with Apu. It's certainly true that stereotypes abound on The Simpsons. Homer is the uneducated white working class male. Lisa is the intelligent, sensitive social justice warrior. Ned Flanders is the over-the-top, robotically moralistic Christian evangelical. If there's a group or a type in society, there's likely a character built around the stereotype in The Simpsons, and that character has some really funny bits. But there's a difference between Lisa and Apu. If you're a woman, you'll see multiple presentations of women in The Simpsons, in particular, and mass media in general. Being a woman, even a white woman, does not force you into seeing Lisa Simpson as the icon representing you. You might be more like Marge, or her sisters, or any of a number of other white female characters. There are a myriad of ways those from other better represented groups see themselves represented. It may be that many of these are derogatory and based on shallow stereotypes, but there is at least a range. What we can infer from this is that there are many ways one can be a member of that group. But in the case of representations of South Asians in the mass media, the only real presence we could see, especially before the emergence of Aziz Ansari, Mindy Kaling, and Cal Penn, and the other very small handful of actors and comics, including Harry Kondabolu himself, was Apu. American society would say that if one was South Asian, there was only one social image. They're all like that. Contemporary American society instills in its citizens a pre-existing bias with respect to South Asians. There tend to be only two depictions of South Asians in the mass media. If you're not a terrorist from Pakistan, then you must be a convenience store owner. This is a preconceived notion that our culture puts in the minds of the majority of people. Humor, it's been argued above, has the ability to reinforce preconceived notions, especially if they're funny. Apu's appearance on The Simpsons is high-quality, genuinely funny material. It also reinforces the stereotype of a group for which there is no counter-narrative or wider range of images. Therefore, the argument is, there's a moral problem with the character of Apu. It's worth noting that as a result of Kondabolu's film and the cultural conversation surrounding it, Hank Azaria, the actor who does the voice of Apu has offered to hand the role over to someone else. Note that the problem pointed out here is with the representation of Apu, and that not that it's false in its representation. It's not that we're lying about South Asians when we represent them as owning convenience stores. We're not saying that they are something they are not or do something they do not. It certainly is the case that there are people who immigrated from South Asia who do own convenience stores. This is a common route for every wave of immigrants. When my great-grandparents came to the United States from Russia, they opened a small neighborhood grocery, the equivalent at the time of a convenience store. It's a way for people new to a culture to establish themselves and create a successful, stable business that gives their kids a foothold from which they'll develop as they will. But if the moral problem isn't falsity, what could possibly be wrong with telling the truth? The problem is that it's a limited truth, a truth that flattens a group and disallows the depth of presentation that other groups enjoy. If you're a white guy, there are plenty of ways to be a white guy, even if you restrict yourself to the world of The Simpsons. Yes, there are people who are more or less, usually less, like cartoon characters, but because the depth is given in the range of characters, there's no moral problem with developing a caricature of them in the way there is with Apu. Because there's no range, the lack of depth reinforces the cultural bias and dehumanizes. And that is a power comedians have, because comedy requires brevity. Because the nature of comedy is a punchy thing. Comedy oversimplifies, exaggerates, flattens. This is not a problem in itself unless it's used to morally problematic ends, which it can be even if not intended. Comedy has power that other speech does not, this line says. If comedy has this extra power, then it must come with extra moral responsibility. So, we have here an argument that there must be greater restrictions on comedy than on other speech. Comedians cannot just say what's true. They must be sure they're not expressing flattening truths that constrain the humanity of those who are already oppressed. So, when someone mounts the stage which is outfitted with the iconic stool and mic stand, are there different sets of moral expectations? Does stand-up comedy free the performer from ethical bounds that are enforced in bona fide communication? Are the moral lines for comedians just where they are for the rest of us? Or are they tighter, restricting comedians because the microphone comes with special power and therefore special responsibility? Some comedians and writers like Lindy West and Hari Kondabolu argue that there need to be moral constraints respected in making us laugh. Others, like Anthony Jeselnik and Roseanne Barr, argue that challenging such moral boundaries is what makes them valuable to the culture. As in Shakespeare, we want the fool to be able to speak truth to power. But, as we've seen, how one speaks that truth is morally important.
Lecture 23, Socially Progressive Comedy.
Okay. There you go.
Perfect.
What's this lecture about?
How jokes can change the world.
Oh. You know, there's a really funny one-liner that changed my world.
Oh?
Yeah. I do. Three times.
There are three very different ways we've traditionally thought about humor. According to the first approach, humor is light, vacuous, and meaningless. Humor is not serious, and therefore not worthy of being taken seriously. Hopefully we've dispelled that. In the second place, humor is seen as socially conservative, as useful in hardening widely shared biases against groups with little social power. This is the result of joke cycles that trade on stereotypes and help demonize and dehumanize those who are looked down upon by the majority. The conversations we've been having about humor ethics so far have hopefully illuminated the moral elements related to that concern. But there's a third sense in which humor is seen as an instrument of change, as a tool of liberation, as a means of progressive social change. Dictators often ban comedy. Authoritarians who want to make sure no one even begins to consider the possibility of social change see humor as a threat, as subversive. German Jewish philosopher Hannah Arendt wrote, "The greatest enemy of authority, therefore, is contempt, and the surest way to undermine it is laughter." Jokes can destabilize political power. Jokes can change the world. What gives humor this ability? It's not accidental that there are so many comic entertainers throughout history who have come from marginalized groups. From the very start of the art form, that is, stand-up comedy, we see a disproportionate number of stars coming from minority communities. Part of this is historical. We see early stand-up performed in shows that catered to minority audiences. From the 1920s to the 1950s, there were two offshoots of vaudeville that greatly shaped American humor. The Borscht Belt was a set of venues aimed at vacationing Jews and was the launchpad of Jewish comedians from Henny Youngman to Jack Benny to Milton Berle. It gave rise to the Jewish influence on American comedy with jokes like this. "I've been in love with the same woman for 49 years. My wife ever finds out, she'll kill me. So somebody stole all my credit cards? I'm not reporting it. The thief spends less than my wife does. My doctor, he gave me 6 months to live. I said, I don't have enough money for the bill, so he gave me another 6 months." At the same time, the Chetland Circuit was formed by a collection of clubs that catered to African-American audiences during the time when American society was segregated. This allowed African-American comedians like Moms Mabley and Red Fox to ascend to stardom. This cemented the African-American influence on American comedy with jokes like this.
"Advice to children crossing the street? Damn, the lights. You better watch out for the cars, because the lights ain't never kill nobody. Somebody asked me, what is it like being married to an old man? I said, honey, I don't know what to say. The best I can explain it is like trying to push a car up a hill with a rope."
The comedy that came out of the Borscht Belt and the Chitlin Circuit was largely apolitical, but it did give voice to the everyday experiences of members of the culture whose voices were usually stifled. However, once Jewish and African-American comedy had established themselves, that is, once these voices came to be heard on a regular basis, what was said by the voices began to change. To be a member of a minority group in America in the 20th century was to experience oppression and cultural alienation ranging from job discrimination to redlining in housing to lynching. This cultural context led to humor becoming overtly political. The generation straddling the Borscht Belt Chitlin Circuit and the modern period of American stand-up began to use humor to both air the grievances of the oppressed and to humorously expose the problems and inequities of American society. Now, humor had been used to affect social change before this, of course. In the 1920s, for example, the political cartoons of Thomas Nast were an instrument in bringing down the corrupt New York Democratic political machine of Boss Tweed. A generation later, the comedy stopped going in the newspapers and instead came out of it with the routines of Will Rogers, a Native American humorist who worked from the newspapers and made explicitly political jokes. He mixed a gentle, folksy image,
"I never met a man I didn't like,"
with a political, often partisan sensibility.
"A Democrat and a Republican will both steal your money, but at least the Democrat will share it with you afterward. The only difference between death and taxes is that death doesn't get worse every time Congress meets. Instead of giving money to found colleges to promote learning, why don't they pass a constitutional amendment prohibiting anybody from learning anything? If it works as good as the Prohibition one did, why, in 5 years, we would have the smartest race of people on earth."
That shtick was picked up several decades later by Jewish comedian Mort Sahl, who would also use what he found in the newspapers as the basis for his act. But Sahl replaced the folksy "aw shucks" of Will Rogers with a 1960s edgy hipness. African Americans were also turning to comedy as a political tool that could be useful in the fight for civil rights. Comedians like Dick Gregory openly took on issues of race, bigotry, and oppression in his comedy. These were topics that were not spoken of publicly, much less as entertainment, but Gregory went straight at it. He performed for both black and white audiences and became famous for unflinchingly taking on racism in his sets. The bit that launched him was this.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I understand there are a good many Southerners in this room tonight. I know the South very well. I spent about 20 years there. One night, last time I was down South, I walked into this restaurant and this waitress came up to me and said, "We don't serve color folk here." I said, "I don't eat colored people. Bring me a whole fried chicken." Then these three white boys came up to me and said, "Boy, we're giving you fair warning. Anything you do to that chicken, we're going to do to you." So I put down my knife and fork. I picked up the chicken and I kissed it. Then I said, "Line up, boys."
What comics like Saul and Gregory launched was the expectation that the art form of comedy would be used as an instrument for progressive social change. From the next generation of comedians, including George Carlin and Richard Pryor, through the likes of Bill Hicks, Margaret Cho, and Dave Chappelle, right up to The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, comedy became an accepted and expected means of punching up, that is, exposing the social and political problems that plagued the nation. Political humor became a standard comic genre. Why does it work? Social change requires three things. First, seeing that there is a problem that needs fixing, that there's a need for change. Second, seeing how the world could be different, re-envisioning the order of things. We call this the moral imagination. Third, actually fomenting the change, bringing about a new way of being in society and in the world. Our question for this discussion then is, what role can, has, and does humor play in each of these? How is humor an agent of social progress? We can also ask, of course, how is humor used to undermine it? Social change is a change in society. I'm a philosopher, I say deep things. Society is a collection of institutions and institutionalized rules and ways of seeing the world that come with enforcement mechanisms. By being a member of society, you're acculturated to maintain that society. The society protects itself and its structure. All social change, no matter how positive or morally necessary, is seen at some level as suspect, as subversive, as something to be pushed back against. Even the voicing of the possibility of social progress is frowned upon. That's one reason why humor is effective. By making the otherwise uncomfortable truth funny, we make it palatable, if not desirable. We enjoy that which would otherwise upset us. Shakespeare knew this. This is why it's often only the fool in Shakespearean plays who's capable of speaking truth to power. For example, in King Lear, it's only the fool who can tell the king that which he does not want to hear about the conniving tactics of his beloved family. Humor seems to be able to grease the skids, to make acceptable talk of things we would otherwise not talk about. Jokes are a non-bona fide means of communication. When we joke about a thing, we remove ourselves from the regular structure and rules of conversational behavior. We say things we know are false. We say things in odd, roundabout ways. We're excused from the usual requirements because we're saying them to cause amusement, not to inform our conversational partner. But jokes are also capable of communicating content, of expressing beliefs and truths. We can use a joke, not just to get laughs, but to say something. "I love your Massaman curry so much, I could bathe in the sauce." That's a joke. I don't really want to get into a tub full of coconut milk and seasonings. Well, not much. But it's a joke that expresses my appreciation of your culinary skill. We could think of such uses of humor as bona fide, non-bona fide communication. We use a non-truth-bearing proposition to convey a truth. Indeed, as we've earlier discussed in this course, truth seems to play a complicated role in humor. Jokes that are completely false will fail to land, right? Consider Dean Martin's old routines. full of jokes about alcohol abuse.
So, strangely enough, it was a woman who drove me to drink. Come to think of it, I never did hang around to thank her for that. You know, I'd hate to be a teetotaler. I mean, could you imagine getting up in the morning knowing that's as good as you're going to feel all day? Yeah.
Dean Martin was a celebrity at a time when that lifestyle included copious amounts of drinking. So the jokes worked. But if those same jokes are told by somebody we knew to be a teetotaler, or, say, if the Pope started doing Dean Martin jokes, it wouldn't be funny. It would just be odd. Okay, the Pope doing Dean Martin would be kind of funny. But the point is that there are surely some jokes that have no relation to truth, like the one we heard about the sheep.
Two sheep are in a field, and one of them says, "I wonder if it's going to rain today." And then a dog walks past, and he says, "No, they're calling for clear skies this afternoon." And the first sheep looks at the second sheep and says, "Oh, my God, a talking dog."
There are no talking dogs or talking sheep. This is a joke that has no intention about telling anything true about the world. But in a number of other jokes, the premise needs to connect to the real world to work. We discussed Matthew Hurley, Daniel Dennett, and Reginald Adams' view of humor in an earlier lecture. They describe the way that we set up a mental space when we hear a joke. That is, we construct an oversimplified joke world that runs on its own logic as dictated by the setup. Okay, so we're in a barnyard and animals can talk. Got it. The setup is schematic, brief, only gives you part of what you need to build this mental joke world, and so we use some of what we believe about the real world to finish off the construction. It's these beliefs about how the world really is that we import into our mental joke world. As such, the joke world has to resemble the real world for many jokes to work. Jokes have to be true to be effective. But that means there will be truth smuggled into the joke. We can use that smuggled truth to question other beliefs. We can show how our smuggled beliefs are contradicted by other beliefs we want to be the case. If we hold all people to be equal, but that we're better than some, we can use a joke to expose that logical problem. Since we believe we should be logically consistent, we're faced with a social issue that needs addressing. But we both hate social inequality and hate having to admit that there's social inequality. And since many of us benefit from social inequality, we are more likely to ignore it than address it. We'll shy away from anything that exposes us to it directly. We will write off those who argue about it as shrill, as annoying, as bleeding hearts or self-interested. But we love to laugh. We love humor. It makes us happy. Humor can be used to raise issues and concerns in a way that sneaks by the gatekeeper that usually disallows them. When we appreciate the joke, we also allow in the worldview from which it came. We may not want to be lectured by someone, but we'll allow them to amuse us. And with the amusement comes the alternative way of looking at things, even if that ridicules us. Consider again political cartoons. They're cartoons. They're meant to be clever and get a chuckle, but they're also meant to state a truth from a point of view. Political cartoons are rhetorical. The point is to come away from the viewing of the political cartoon believing something about a politician or a policy. Thomas Nast did want people to be outraged by the Tammany Hall scandals and to take action, just like political cartoonists today, from Pat Oliphant to Mark Fiore. The hard question, though, is what happens when that truth is inserted into a culture that needs changing? If there are pre-existing biases and inequities, can't those shape how these truths are received? In this way, can't those biases keep the real need for change from being fully understood? The answer, of course, is yes. The case study in this is a set of circumstances at the end of The Chappelle Show. Comedian Dave Chappelle had a sketch comedy series that was setting the world on fire. He became a household name. But then he abruptly ended his program and left comedy. The public was baffled. Why would someone at the top of his game, at the height of his fame, just walk away? The story is that Chappelle was taping a bit for the show. Now, in the routine, Dave Chappelle, world-known celebrity, is on a long flight, and the stewardess comes over to take his meal order. He has the choice of chicken or fish. He prefers the chicken over the fish, but afraid that even he, a celebrity, cannot order fried chicken as a black man without feeding into a stereotype. His alter ego, a black-faced minstrel singer who embodies all the racial stereotypes African Americans have had to endure, urges him to order the chicken. The sketch was intended to be a piece that addressed the complexities of being an African American in a culture that has a tradition of inequality. But as he was taping the part of the alter ego, playing up the stereotypical elements to the level of absurdity, he heard someone off stage laughing hysterically. For a comedian, this should have been a good thing, right? But it was clearly a white person laughing at the stereotype. The tone of the laughter seemed derisive, and it led Chappelle to wonder and ultimately become convinced that he was not displaying the problems of the stereotype in the minds of some of his viewers. Rather, he was entrenching the stereotype himself. He was not challenging the social problem, but inadvertently becoming part of it. So, does humor expose social inequality and other injustices? It can. But given that it occurs in a cultural context, can it do the opposite? It can. Humor may be a sword, but it's a double-edged one. Humor is capable of leading us to ask questions about social fairness. But that's just the first step. Social progress requires us not only to realize that there is a problem, but to start to consider solutions. This means we need to be able to envision the world as being other than it is. We need to employ our moral imagination to develop alternative, possible worlds and see if the new ones are more fair, more just, and more liable to lead to general human flourishing. Is humor an aid in this process? Recall from an earlier discussion Noel Carroll's argument that our jokes about another group tell us less about that group than they tell us about ourselves. The negative characteristics we select to attach to a given group are reflective of what we fear or disdain about ourselves. If we say of a given ethnic group that they're cheap or stupid or lazy or drunk, then the fact that we selected those particular characteristics to place on a group to disparage them says something about the values and moral concerns of the mainstream of our own culture. When we pin those on someone else, we declare something about the ideal of the mainstream. And usually it's because the mainstream fails to live up to the ideal that we have to find someone else to target. We use the other as the embodiment of our own flaws and weaknesses. But are those characteristics we ought to seek to change? Are they properties we rightly see as problematic, or are there others? When we think about our own jokes, they tell us something about the direction we need to look in order to aid social progress. What in this society needs to change, and what are the positive alternatives we should take seriously? These are political and policy questions that can be answered by putting our own joke cycles under the metaphorical microscope of the sociologist. Look, for example, at ethnic, sexist, and homophobic jokes. They tell us not only who the outgroups are, that is, who is marginalized by society, but they also tell us how we keep them marginalized. The qualities we stock the stereotypes of those we mock do not necessarily belong to the members of those groups, but, Carroll argues, they are the qualities we fear in ourselves. They're the properties we have deemed to be undesirable, and we try to soothe our own fears of being stupid, dirty, greedy, drunkards, effeminate, or whatever else is socially undesirable by placing those characteristics into the essence of someone we separate from ourselves. A related question regarding humor and political affiliation has been considered by a number of thinkers. Why are so many more comedians liberal than conservative? Why do those who seek to change society more often end up as professional humorists compared with those who seek to maintain the structure? Political scientist Alison Dagnes asked this question in her book, A Conservative Walks Into a Bar. She interviewed comedians and comedy writers about their views of politics and their own backgrounds. In the end, she draws an interesting conclusion. Part of it, she says, may be structural. People prefer to hang out with people like them, and when you hang out with someone, you include them in your professional network. Since many comics are liberal, they will befriend, mentor, and offer opportunities more often to other liberal comics. But another angle she speculates about is education. A disproportionate number of successful comics she spoke with came from a liberal arts background. They studied at schools that focus their curriculum on requiring students to become comfortable adopting multiple, sometimes conflicting, perspectives. These students likely took philosophy classes or other courses that force them to understand how something looks when viewed through very different eyes, and that celebrated the insight that comes from this sort of process. This, of course, feeds into comedy, which often turns on the sorts of incongruities that arise from seeing something normal in an unusual way. But not all comics are college educated. Indeed, a lot, especially those in minority groups, would not have had access to this sort of educational opportunity. Yet we see the same thing for the same sort of reason. In any decade of the 20th or 21st century, there's been a disproportionate number of comedians who have come from minority groups. Whether it was the Borscht Belt comics from the 50s, African-American comedians in the 1970s and 80s, the rise of Latino comedy in the 80s and 90s, or today's wide range of voices, including prominent comics from the Asian and GLBTQ communities. Comedy is one place we find many people having a louder voice than in the general political discourse. Why is this? W.E.B. Du Bois was one of the first great figures in sociology in the early 20th century and an African American. His great work, The Souls of Black Folks, changed the world by presenting a thoughtful and scientific account of what marginalization does to the human mind and culture. He developed the view that members of a minority community will have what he termed double consciousness. When one group controls the society, then that group possesses the social capital that comes with power. That group also controls the language, the values, the categories that make up the world. That group gets to determine the rules of the game. As such, when you're not of that group, when you're from a minority group, you have to learn to see the world as the powerful see it, speak as the powerful speak, act as the powerful act. But back home, you have your own language, values, speech patterns, and ways of being. Minority members are forced to live culturally bifurcated lives. But having different lenses through which to see the world can also be an advantage. It gives you insight by allowing you to see things in a way that most people with only the single cultural lens do not. This can be useful in terms of innovation, but also in terms of humor. The world will seem a constant incongruity, and if you're clever enough to be able to express it linguistically, you have an advantage in comedy. The system tends to disadvantage minorities, and so members of minority groups tend to support changing the system. Their ability to see things another way also aids in their ability to see how the world could be different. Contemporary neuroscience gives us results that are consistent with the sociological take on the matter. In studies such as that carried out by Kania, Fiden, Firth, and Reese, published in the journal Current Biology, it turns out that political liberals tend to have enlarged anterior cingulates. This is the part of the brain that deals with ambiguity and resolving complex problems. Political conservatives tend to have a larger amygdala, the part of the brain that deals with immediate reaction to threat and fear. We know that the anterior cingulate is also very involved in the brain's processing of humor. So this accidental correlation may play some explanatory role in showing why the humor scale tilts in one political direction towards those who have a propensity for seeing things as possibly other than they are. Now, this does not